All right, so we're diving into, say, Fuji v. California today. This case really took on those California alien land laws that were, specifically meant to keep Asian immigrants from owning land.
Right. And you have to remember this is 1948.
Yeah, 1948.
And we have our protagonist, Sei Fuji, a Japanese immigrant who says, "You know what? I'm not going to just sit back and let this
Was
happen."
not going to take it.
He's not going to take it. And what's amazing is this case even brings in the UN Charter, believe it or not.
Oh, wow. Okay. So this is going to be a good one.
Yeah, it goes way beyond just land. This gets into, real deep systemic prejudice.
Yeah. It's about more than just property rights, for sure. But okay, before we get into all the legal ins and outs, can we set the scene a bit? Like, what exactly happened with Fuji?
Sure. So basically, the alien land law said if you couldn't become a U.S. citizen, you couldn't own land.
Okay.
And at the time, Japanese immigrants were barred from becoming citizens.
Yes.
So Fuji buys this piece of land in 1948, and the state is like, nope, not happening. We're taking it away. And they use this law to justify it.
So they're just denying him this basic right because of his heritage. I mean, that's pretty blatant, isn't it?
It was. And to really grasp how big of a challenge Fuji's case was, we need to look back a bit. Cases like Terrace v. Thompson in 1923 come to mind. Back then, courts were actually upholding these laws. It was a totally different legal world.
So Fuji is going up against decades of precedent here. Talk about an uphill battle. What happened when he took it to court?
Okay, so this is where it gets really interesting. The Court of Appeal actually overturns the law. They cited the UN Charter and its human rights provisions.
Wait, seriously, they use the UN Charter in a U.S. court case.
Yeah, but it didn't stick. Ultimately, the California Supreme Court comes in and says, hold on a second. They basically ruled that the UN Charter, at least in this specific situation, couldn't just override state law.
I see.
You see, it wasn't what's called a self-executing treaty.
So it needed like backing from Congress or something to have real power.
Exactly.
Okay, that's fascinating. So even international human rights documents have limitations within the U.S. system.
Yeah.
So what was it then that actually took down that alien land law?
It was the 14th Amendment, specifically the Equal Protection Clause, that part that guarantees equal protection under the law for everyone in the U.S.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. But how do they actually apply that to Fuji's case? I mean, how do you connect those dots?
Well, the court basically called out the discrimination for what it was. They said, look, this law was designed to target Japanese farmers. They used the fact that they couldn't become citizens as a weapon against them.
Right.
And remember, that inability was solely because of their race. Federal law at the time completely blocked Asian immigrants from becoming citizens.
So it's like a double whammy of discrimination. You
Yeah.
target them based on race, and then you use that exact same discrimination to deny them the right to own land.
Exactly. And this was a huge shift in legal thinking. Earlier cases like Oyama and Takahashi had, started to chip away at these alien land laws, but Fuji was the final blow. It set a completely new standard.
So the court basically said you can't use someone's race as an excuse to deny them the right to own property.
Right.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
But what was their legal basis for that? Did they have like a specific legal tool to actually dismantle this law?
They did. It's called strict scrutiny. Basically, when a law targets what's called a suspect classification, things like race or national origin, the courts apply this, really tough standard of review.
So because the alien land law so obviously targeted a specific racial group, the court said, hold on, we're going to scrutinize this very, very carefully.
Exactly. And under that level of scrutiny, California couldn't prove that barring Japanese immigrants from owning land was, necessary for public safety or anything else. There was no legitimate reason for it.
So the state tried to defend their law, but the court basically said, nope, we're siding with Fuji. They declared that alien land law unconstitutional. What a victory. But I'm guessing it wasn't quite that simple. There had to be some pushback, right? Some different opinions within the court itself.
Oh, you're absolutely right. We can't forget about those dissenting opinions. Justice Schauer, for example, argued that being eligible for citizenship was, a valid reason for making a distinction. He felt the court was overstepping its boundaries by, overturning a law created by the legislature.
So he saw it as judicial activism.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. So even in a case that, at first glance seems so clear-cut, there are these different interpretations. There's complexity there.
Absolutely. And exploring those different views gives us a much richer understanding of the case.
Right.
It reminds us that the law isn't always black and white, you know, and that the role of the courts in actually protecting individual rights is always being debated.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a constant conversation. All right, so we've established that the court ruled in Fuji's favor, but it sounds like there was more to it than just saying, this law is bad, get rid of it. What else did the court's decision actually highlight? So we've established that the court ruled in Fuji's favor and struck down that alien land law, but it sounds like there was more to it than just, you know, saying, this law is bad, get rid of it. What else did the court's decision highlight?
You're right. The court's reasoning, it went beyond just declaring the law unconstitutional. Chief Justice Gibson, he wrote the majority opinion, and he really focused on the economic damage these laws caused.
So it wasn't just theoretical. It was about the real-life impact on people.
Exactly. He emphasized how these laws, you know, they forced immigrants into this inferior economic position. They couldn't build wealth or really establish themselves. Imagine not even being able to own a home.
It's powerful how the court connected those legal principles to their, you know, their actual consequences.
Yeah. And this theme of real-world impact was echoed by Justice Carter in his concurring opinion. He was even more direct. He called out the blatant anti-Japanese sentiment behind these laws, you know, labeled them a relic of a prejudiced past.
So even though they all agreed the law was unconstitutional, the different justices had their own, like, perspectives and emphasis.
Mm-hmm.
It shows how much depth there is even in the unanimous decision.
Absolutely. And it reminds us that legal reasoning is this complex process, you know, with room for these nuanced perspectives even within a unified judgment.
We've talked about the immediate impact of the case on California's alien land laws, but did Say Fuji v. California have any, like, broader lasting effects?
Oh, the ripple effects were huge. It set a precedent that, you know, echoed in future cases challenging discrimination against non-citizens. A big example is Graham v. Richardson in 1971. Supreme Court, they struck down laws that denied welfare benefits to non-citizens. Their reasoning, it relied heavily on the equal protection principles that Fuji established.
So Fuji wasn't just about land then. It was about something much bigger, establishing that non-citizens have fundamental rights under the Constitution.
Exactly. And we have to remember the historical context, too, right? This was post-World War II. It was a time when awareness of, you know, racial discrimination's horrors was growing. The world had seen the consequences of unchecked prejudice. Change was in the air.
So Fuji was part of this broader movement toward equality. It makes you think about how relevant it is to today's issues, mm-hmm. especially with those debates on immigration and belonging still so, you know, so heated. Are there any parallels we can draw?
That's the key question. While we've made progress since the alien land laws, their shadow, it still lingers. Debates about immigration, access to resources, even property rights, they all raise these same questions about equality and inclusion. Think about things like sanctuary cities, healthcare for undocumented immigrants, the rights of non-citizens facing deportation.
It sounds like the fight for equal protection is far from over. The principles in Fuji, they're just as relevant today.
Absolutely. It's a powerful reminder that achieving justice, it's an ongoing process, and we have to be, you know, vigilant in protecting the rights of all individuals, regardless of their citizenship status. Equal protection, it should apply to everyone within our borders.
That's a powerful message. But before we wrap up, I want to go back to those dissenting opinions for a second. We talked about how Justice Schauer believed the court was overstepping and, you know, engaging in judicial activism. Can you expand on that a bit?
Dissenting opinions, they're often overlooked, but they're crucial because they force us to think critically, you know, to consider different angles. Justice Schauer's dissent, it raises a fundamental question about the role of the judiciary in a democracy. Where do we draw the line between upholding existing laws and interpreting the Constitution to protect, you know, fundamental rights, especially when those rights might not be explicitly written in the legislation?
It looks like this balancing act between respecting the legislature's authority and making sure that individual rights aren't, you know, trampled on.
Exactly. While Fuji ultimately sided with protecting individual rights, Schauer's dissent reminds us of that tension, you know, between judicial power and legislative authority. It compels us to think about who gets to define justice.
This has been such an insightful look at, say, Fuji v. California. We've covered the historical context, the legal intricacies, and its lasting legacy. A case that really continues to shape our understanding of equality and justice in America. You know, as we've been talking about this case, I keep thinking about Say Fuji himself. It's pretty incredible when you think about the courage it must have taken to, you know, challenge the system that was so deeply rooted in prejudice.
Yeah, and what I find really striking is he wasn't a lawyer or politician. He was a sociologist. But he understood that, you know, things wouldn't change unless someone stood up and said, this is wrong. It's a powerful reminder that we all have a role to play in creating a more just world.
That's a good point. I think it's easy to feel kind of powerless when you're up against these huge systemic issues. But Fuji, I mean, he shows us that individual action can make a difference. And it wasn't just him, right? There must have been others who supported him in this fight.
Oh, absolutely. Safe Fuji v. California, this was a team effort.
Yeah.
Lawyers, activists, I mean, entire organizations, they all saw how important this case was. And they, you know, they rallied behind him. It just shows you how much stronger we are when we work together to fight injustice.
It really is a testament to the power of community and allyship.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Safe Fuji v. California, what are like the key takeaways you hope our listeners will remember?
For me, it's, you know, the lasting power of the Equal Protection Clause. This case shows how this seemingly simple phrase can be this powerful tool for, you know, dismantling discrimination and protecting fundamental rights.
It's like a shield against injustice, and it's something we should all be aware of and ready to defend.
Exactly. And it really highlights how the Constitution is a living document. It's not static. It can, you know, adapt to the challenges of each generation. It's up to us to interpret and apply its principles to make sure there's justice for everyone.
That's a really powerful thought. It reminds me of something you said earlier about the, you know, the importance of the judiciary in upholding those principles, even when it means going against the grain.
Right. Safe Fuji really underscores how important the courts are in challenging the status quo. It shows how judicial action can be a real catalyst for social progress.
But as we've seen, progress rarely comes easy. Safe Fuji v. California serves as this powerful reminder that the fight for a more inclusive society takes constant effort. It takes courage, it takes commitment, and it takes the willingness to challenge injustice wherever we see it.
Well said. You know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And cases like Fuji, they light the way toward a more equitable future.
This deep dive has been incredibly insightful. Safe Fuji v. California isn't just some historical footnote. It's this living testament to the, you know, the ongoing struggle for equality and justice.
Well, thank you for joining us on this journey. We hope it's, you know, sparked your interest in this remarkable case and its lasting impact.
And to our listeners, thank you for diving in with us. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep pushing for a world where everyone is treated with dignity and respect.